So I'm going to talk about some recent results in extragalactic microlensing. This is sort of two different projects. Katie forced me to add the M31 bits. So towards M31, that's the Andromeda Galaxy. It's mostly the PhD thesis of Robert Ugelsich at Columbia. This is also work with Arlen Kratz, his thesis advisor. But I'm mostly going to talk about an HST data set for M87. This is sort of a giant elliptical in the Virgo cluster. And there's a big collaboration, but Todd Lauer and Dave Zurich did all the hard work, and then I did some post-processing of the image processing. Okay. So, briefly mention what gravitational microlensing is. Basically, stellar objects can act as gravitational lenses, and this can be any sort of dense objects, you know, stars, black holes, whatever. And typical relative motions in galactic systems mean that these magnifications are transient. Now, there's a characteristic scale in the problem. It's called the Einstein radius, and you get significant magnification if a lens passes within an Einstein radius of the line of sight to a source that you're considering. And it's basically the geometric mean of the source shell radius of the lens with some geometric factors. This is distance to the lens, distance between the lens and the source, and this is the distance, the full distance to the source. And here are some microlensing light curves, sort of what they look like. And here are the trajectories relative to the Einstein radius, the ring there. So you can get quite large magnifications, magnification on this axis. Now, for typical galactic values of these things, the Einstein radius is typically 10 AU, so this is pretty small. This is a cross-section for lensing. It's quite small. You have to monitor millions of stars by hook or by crook to detect microlensing. And again, for galactic velocities, the timescales are typically 100 days or so. So you have to monitor millions of stars over that sort of timescale to detect microlensing. Now, this is a great technique because it's really sensitive to any sort of solar mass-ish objects, whether or not they're shining. So this is a technique to look for massive dark objects in galactic halos. And the Macho project has done this over the last decade, monitoring the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is one of the satellites of the Milky Way, the line of sight through some of the inner halo of the Milky Way, and here's some of their fields in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So there's some objects lensing stars in the LMC, and they come to a rather surprising conclusion, and that is that 20% of the Milky Way halo, at least out that far, looks like it is some kind of lensing object, and these are sort of order half a solar mass.
Excuse me, I haven't followed the developments over the last few years. I thought it used to be that maybe 20%, but consistent with zero. Is zero ruled out now?
It's a little, I think, people make arguments about, well, maybe we don't understand the LMC because there is a self-lensing contribution, because, of course, an LMC star can lens another LMC star. But I think, I mean, these results are fairly robust, you know, given that you think you understand the LMC. But I think that zero is pretty hard to come up with.
But wasn't it true, Ted, that for the SMC, weren't there two where they had the distances between right. the binaries and they were both self-lenses?
Right, but there's a big selection effect because to get distances you want binaries and are the... I mean, if you detected a binary in the LMC, then I think it'd be a little...
See, an even more stupid question, 20% of what?
20% of the full mass of the galactic halo. So you have some idea of how massive the Milky Way halo is, and if it was consistent, if it was made of lenses, we see only 20% of that, but still it's not zero.
But it could be self-lensing, so it could be zero.
It could be self-lensing, but it's, you know, given that you understand, given the LMC model, it doesn't look...
Well, if you assume it's not self-lensing, then it's...
Well, I mean, you have to come up with a...
But it's, I'm not against the 20%, but I'm just, I mean, I just...
Well, it's not that you assume that it's not self-lensing. It's you start with a model of the LMC, and you compute the self-lensing rate. And, you know, people can argue about... You can argue about this. You can argue about this. This isn't my data, so ask somebody else.
Do the red boxes mean where events have been found?
No, these are just, these are the red boxes are the fields that they sample a lot, and then they're fewer fields. I mean, they less often.
Oh, the events are not shown on this.
No, the events, this is just sort of, I mean, you have to do this big, it's just illustrating that to monitor tens of millions of stars, it's hard. You have to do this. I mean, the red boxes are pretty much nightly. And, okay, but, you know, as people have been pointing out, this is a surprising result, and we'd want to confirm this with other lines of sight. So, the LMC is the nearest, brightest, bright-ish thing, so we have to go to larger distances to sample more of the halo and, different lines of sight, and we want to poke a different hole through the Milky Way halo. All right, so M31 is sort of the next obvious target. It's the nearest large galaxy. It's sort of 700 kiloparsecs away. But now the individual stars are not resolved, so you have to do what's called pixel microlensing, though it's really a bit of a misnomer. You're doing image subtraction. You construct a reference image with hopefully low noise properties by making some stack, some average stack, and then you subtract that stack from individual frames. And then when you're done, any sources in those different frames are variable objects, assuming you've done this all correctly. And
stack means repeated pixels of the same pixel.
Yeah. You have just repeated frames taken of the same target, and you construct a reference image from some sample of those, and then you subtract that reference image from each of the individual frames and the stuff that... And then you have some difference images, which, if there are no variables, should in principle be shot noise. And
just to get some feeling, what is the sort of typical fluctuation from one image to another?
You really can get down to pretty much down to shot noise in the difference images. Is that?
What's shot noise?
Just the photon counting noise.
Within photon counting those two different nights or whatever will be the same.
Yeah, you can do the photometric alignments and all the alignments correctly enough that if there's no variables, your difference image really is pretty much just shot noise. So this is a fairly robust technique. Well, anyway, the PhD thesis of Robert Ugelstich was to do a three-season survey of M31 from the ground with the MDM 1.3-meter telescope. And it's sort of broken up into seasons because it's when is this thing visible from a spot in the northern hemisphere. And there's an event sample of 27 candidate microlensing events. And the expectation from just self-lensing, which is mostly for bulge stars, lensing other bulge stars, is that there are 8 expected. And furthermore, you can get an idea of what the spatial distribution of those, of a self-lensing only signal should look like. And what this event sample looks like is not that. There are too many events that are too high of a, too large distance from where you expect the self-lensing for this to be consistent with.
Is the distribution pretty much uniform across the whole M31 or more in the northern?
Well, that's a good question. There is an asymmetry expected because this galaxy is highly tilted. So if you're lensing stars towards the back edge, you're poking through more of M31 halo, and M31 is perhaps even larger than the Milky Way. So in fact, if there are lenses, you're dominated by the lenses in the M31 halo rather than the ones in the Milky Way halo, since in fact, it's the line of sight to M31 in the Milky Way, the core of the Milky Way is behind you. So you're not sampling the densest parts of the Milky Way halo when you look at M31. But yes, And because of that, in fact, the far side was sampled much more densely, because that's where you expect to see events. But there is a control field. One of these 27 events is in the control field, which is on the near side. But you don't expect equal sensitivities on those two sides just because the far side was sampled more densely.
And this is all multicolor. So
this is all in two colors.
Yeah. So it's monochromatic.
No, it's not. And the problem is, because all these sources are highly blended, you have some background color of the light that falls inside a resolution element, which includes the star being lensed. So the star gets lensed, but if the star is not the same color, then basically what you get out is the color of the source being lensed. And hopefully that is time independent. Or, you know, just said in a different way, hopefully there's a good joint fit in the two bands that has the same center time and the same width. So and if you know, I've been talking about this slide too much. That's my cue. If you know what the analog of a classical microlensing survey where the sources are resolved and then the magnification should be the same in both bands is just that the achromaticity is time independent, or just the joint fit in two colors is good.
So this effect you just mentioned about the far side and the near side
right.
would be in principle a test then, right? So
yes, exactly.
We have a lot of data.
Exactly.
Because there should be more on the far side.
Yes. Yes, that was pointed out by Arlen Kratz in the early 90s. And just this data set isn't quite there for doing that test. And this is one PhD thesis. But there's a very large survey in progress, the same group, and doing much better in both fields with larger telescopes. And
So when that test is possible, should really be a lead pipe?
Oh, absolutely.
Clear distinction between self-lensing and...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's the European survey too, right?
Yes, there's a Agape, yes.
Do they also see a factor of 3 pi away?
No, actually, they had a paper this summer that says that maybe lenses are not necessary. So this is sort of in disagreement with them. Okay. So, but it turns out that this is consistent with, the results are consistent with the Large Magellanic Cloud results. You sort of get an order 20% halo required, sort of order half solar mass lenses. And as I said, there's a larger survey in progress. And I'm just going to flash. I'm going to flash the maximum likelihood plot. This is what I've been working on, is simulating the event rate at M31. You've got a number of components. You have the bulge, you have the disk, and those where sources come from, but they're also a supply of lenses. And you have the halos of M31 and of the Milky Way. And furthermore, you get timescale distributions for these events. And you can fold all of this in to the event distribution and compute a likelihood function for the mass and the halo macho fraction. And we find that no halo is disfavored. And these are 1, 2, 3, and 4 sigma contours. Sort of the central value is sort of 30% and, you know, 0.2 or 0.3 solar masses. But the errors are pretty big. This is going to improve greatly in the full mega data set, and that's the Columbia group analyzed.
So this is a model for the halo of M31, which
right.
is the same model as the halo for our galaxy,
right.
and convolved with this experiment.
Right, and you have a model for the bulge of M31 and the disk of M31 and just the sources of lenses. And you just
translated both for M31 and for the galaxy. What is the ratio of baryons in the halo to baryons in the galaxy?
Well, we don't know what these lenses are, so can't even say that they're baryons.
Well, say that they're baryons. Is it the same? I mean, are there as many baryons in the halo as in the galaxy, or does the galaxy dominate?
Well, I mean, if it really is 20% of the full halo, then you're starting to see, look at, you know, it's hard that for that to be baryons, if it's 20% of the full halo, it's sort of of order all the baryons in the universe if this is a universal result.
Can you answer with just the Macho fraction?
Well, that's the fraction of the dark matter, essentially. So, it could, the baryons could be a fifth of the total clustering material in the universe. That's, I think, still, I mean, omega total H squared could be 0.1, so the baryons could be a fifth, and that's sort of what this is pointing you at. If this really is sort of a universal. Yeah, that's too many baryons.
We did this, tried to get a cosmological estimate from the Milky Way, and you're okay. It's pushing it, but it's not too many. I have to show you the numbers. I don't remember the details because it's okay, but it's pretty mammoth.
Yeah, it's hard to do. I mean,
omega baryons, not omega H squared, but omega baryons is probably 0.04 or less.
Right. Well, I was just the numbers that, you know, omega BH squared is 0.02 with a small error bar, and omega matter H squared, I mean, it could be 0.1. It could be
significant fraction of the baryons, but it doesn't have to be too many.
Yeah, I mean, sort of half of the baryons at reg of zero are missing anyway, sort of order.
If that omega H squared in galaxies, it might be 0.1, and then fifth of it is just on the hairy edge.
Of course, it's more interesting if these things are white dwarfs, then their progenitors had more baryons in them, so it gets even tougher. But it's.
Well, what I'm also concerned about is, if this is sort of typical, and then you go to a cluster environment,
right?
And you say that, the gas tells me the baryon fraction.
Well, that tells you the.
Well,
it tells you the gas fraction. That cluster.
Containing a significant amount of baryons. In clusters.
Well, the cluster data tells you the cluster gas fraction, not the cluster baryon fraction.
No,
yeah.
But you have to correct that. And usually the correction is small.
Right.
Because you just add up all the light.
Right.
But maybe you're supposed to multiply it by, I don't know, a factor 2 or something like that, and then it's not so negligible.
Right. Right. Yeah, that could that could be a problem.
Do you assume all of the matters have the same mass?
No. Actually, yes. So these masses are delta functions. So I just pick a delta function and compute compute some likelihood function. We threw in, a scalar mass function, and it's not all that different from sort of where the centroid of the mass function is, because lensing smears out the mass function so much that if you look at, in denumber the log mass, or I think it's log of that. I think it's the appropriate thing to look at. I mean, scalar mass function is not so wide. It looks, I mean, all these mass functions just look like bumps. All right. Okay, now I'm going to move on to.
I just wanted to question. It wasn't about the curve so much, but if the mean mass is that big, what's the likelihood of being able to detect? I mean, these things should be visible at some level.
Well, if they're stars, yeah.
If they're stars, they're nuclear burning for the most part.
Even if they're white dwarfs, they would be cold.
Yeah, they probably. Yeah, so I mean, at some level, if you do a sensitive search, you should be able to detect them.
It's possible, but if they're if they're an M31 halo.
How do you know they're not stars?
Because it's ruled out by a bunch of other things, right? The HST would have seen them.
Would have seen.
I'm assuming these are the same objects as an R halo.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. So
well, they're in a sense they're not, because these are. I mean, you're expected to be dominated by the M31 halo. So now looking for a half solar mass star at 700 kiloparsecs, that gets real tough.
Yeah, what are their prospects for being able to detect those things?
I don't know the.
If there's a white dwarf, there's no way. I mean, there's no way for a white dwarf.
Of course.
Remember, they just finally found old white dwarfs in a nearby galactic cluster. Yeah. That was a big deal. This is further away by a factor of 10. So.
Yeah.
We could say in our galaxy, this 20% cannot be things. The limit is 3% of our galaxy isn't going to stop. So, assuming that these are I guess it's not going to make.
All right. So now I'm going to.
Can I ask you about white dwarfs as the sources in the lens, in the lensing problem? Is it known that are there known examples of white dwarfs as the source?
I think they're too dim. I mean, these are the sources here are mostly red giants.
Yeah, mostly.
Well, I think he's missing the source with the lens.
What?
You want to talk about the lensing star?
I want to talk about the source.
Oh, the source star.
Well, there are examples of very high magnifications in lensing. And,
right.
And part of the story may be that dim light dwarfs are very numerous.
Well, we do get the color of the source, and they're all sort of red giantish. And in fact, we make a cut on color. We don't want, if the source is too blue, we just throw it away, because the blue bumpers are a class of variable star that is troubling.
I see. So it might be that there are white dwarfs in sources.
It's possible, though it's quite unlikely, because I mean a bright blue star. You know, compare a white dwarf, what factor would you have to magnify it by to get to the same, I mean, it's a factor of, it's a large factor. And the cross-section, as a function of magnification, basically goes like 1 over the magnification. So if you need 10 times more magnification, the cross-section is the 10th. And I think that's not even close to getting down to, a bright blue main sequence star versus a white dwarf. I don't think there are.
I have an ulterior motive.
Okay.
I think there's an interference effect that may be visible if the source is a white dwarf.
Oh, if the source is a small one.
The ones like the other.
Right. And then they give you a measure.
But yeah, I mean.
It would give you a geometric measure of the path.
Well, yeah, a white dwarf would be a good source if you could see them, because they're so small. The finite source size effects would be negligible. But I think they're just way too dim.
Yeah, no, for that, you actually might want to look at extended horizontal branch or UV stars. Extremely bright UV stars, they're very small.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely not as they are less rare than white dwarfs at the same magnitude. So for in terms of a source, that's probably a better bet. White dwarfs, it still might be hopeless.
But. All right, I'm gonna move on to M87, which is the giant elliptical in the Virgo cluster. Now we're talking about 16 megaparsecs away, so this is another factor of 20 more distant, and you need HST for this. So we got 30 orbits of HST data with the WIFPIC2 camera. So we took one snapshot once a day, we get a month-long survey. So what we did was a 4-point box dither in the F814 wide filter, and this is essentially I-band. And then there was one snapshot with 400 seconds in the 606 filter, and that's sort of a wide V. So we do get color information, and these 5 exposures were all taken in the same orbit. And then so in orbits, the target rises above the Earth's horizon for 45 minutes or so. And then we do that once a day for 30 days. And we have 2 data reductions done by Todd Lauer and Dave Zurek. So we have completely independent reductions. And hopefully they agree, and they basically do. And I'm going to talk about preliminary analysis. It's mostly in the WIF 2, 3, and 4 chips in the 814 filter. So this is not including the PC chip, which is what we did. We centered the PC on the center of the galaxy. So this is a little bit off center. So you need to do a cosmic ray or hot pixel subtraction. And we find that no matter what you do, the hot pixels are always a problem. So there's always some tail of them that are, do you subtract this or not? But they're not really that egregious, except if you're doing a variable source survey. So we have to be very careful about hot pixels and explain sort of some of the things we did to get rid of them.
What's a hot pixel? It's an electronic
problem? Yeah, it's a pixel decides that its dark noise is large for some time and then decides that, okay, I'm done now. And there's a lot of these guys and at various levels of annoyance. And the trouble is there's just some power law of them, so there's some that are just do this a little bit, but if you're trying to really dig down into the noise to pick out variable sources. The hot pixel is very troublesome. Okay, so the frames, the images were registered from the globular cluster system in M87. And then we constructed a reference image from 29 of the 30 frames. The 12th frame was a little bit blurred. So we have this reference image. So the noise in the reference image compared to each individual image is going to be sort of 1 over root 29. And we've done some tests. We really do get down to shot noise. So really photon counting noise is the thing that is most important. So what happens is from this reference image, we construct a noise image, in a sense, which is just a PSF squared convolution of the reference image. I won't get into that unless you're really interested. And then you take the difference images are constructed by just subtracting each individual frame. You subtract the reference image from each frame. And then what happens is we build this signal-to-noise image. This is what we've been calling it. What that is, it's a PSF, that's one power convolution of the difference image, sort of divided by the this noise image, which is a PSF squared convolution of the reference image. And this is sort of the optimal filter, though I'm not going to get into that because it's a little complicated. And then these result images, which are just the pixel values, are just signal to noise above or below reference. We search the stack of these for variable sources. All right, so here's an example of what I'm talking about. Here's the unsubtracted image. The stars are mostly globular clusters in the M87 halo. Subtract off the reference image and, well, it looks like shot noise. It's not quite. You can see there are a couple of little artifacts here. Sometimes the globulars don't subtract perfectly. So essentially what happens is if the source is too near a globular, we have to be very careful. I mean, is this a bad subtraction or is it a real source? In fact, we see a few events that are due to bad subtractions. And actually, we do see an event from a globular cluster that is not a bad subtraction. So I'm going to talk about those.
What is the globular cluster doing that causes this?
Well, since it's so bright, if your alignment is not perfect, then even so, some of it is just the noise goes way up because it's much brighter in a very small area.
So am I missing some point? If you worry a bit about imperfect alignment with something as extended as a globular cluster, doesn't it overwhelm looking for a star?
It's not. I mean, we're talking small fractions of a pixel alignment issues. It's just that the globulars are so bright compared to the surrounding environs that any time, if you could do the best you can in aligning with the full globular cluster system, there's going to be some tiny error, and sometimes that's enough that the globular, there's a little bit of an artifact.
So how big is a pixel, for example?
Oh, geez. I mean, these dots are all pixels. I don't know if you can see them. The pixels on this camera are 0.1 arc second.
So one pixel is like a dot on this second picture?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the dots here. Okay, and then here's the result image. You see it's a little more smoothed out. That's because of the PSF convolution. And
I didn't understand all this shorthand. So I got the second picture from the first one by subtracting the standard image.
Right.
And how did I go from the second to the third one?
Now what I did is I do a PSF convolution of this image.
PSF?
The point spread function. So it's basically just if I have a point source, a true point source, what does that look like in the telescope? It's not just in one pixel, it's in several. And if I just take that pattern and convolve it with this image, I get something that looks like that. And that's the appropriate thing to do, because if I have a point source, it's not going to be one pixel. It's going to look like the point spread function in the difference image.
So I subtract from this, from the middle image, something that corresponds to a lot of point sources spread out by this.
No. I do a convolution. So at each point in this image is basically, I take the dot product of this point spread function, which is...
So if I were to take the last image and do this
I take...
If I something, I would get the middle image.
No, I take this, you smear it, and you get the last image.
But the last image looks less smeared than the middle one, obviously.
No, it doesn't. The size of the structure on here is...
Oh, because of my glasses. Oh, you mean because the middle image has a lot of white and black points, right?
Right. This is just, this is shot noise, but pixel by pixel, and this is smoothed by PSF, so all these little lumps are several pixels across. Yes. Right. Yeah. And so the pixel values here are basically just a signal to noise, but then you do the PSF convolution, and then you divide by this noise image. So this is sort of the pattern. And then take the stack of these and look for variable sources. And this is how that was done. So I developed this analysis on one of the chips only to try to get something that agreed with my eyeballs, and then to have some more data to apply this blindly to, just make sure I wasn't biasing the entire data set. So the first thing, so I had to set a baseline. If I have any event that goes positive, that the positive points exist in the reference image also. So the true baseline is actually at negative values. So what I do is just take the average of the 10 lowest samples and call that the baseline. That turns out to work pretty well. And then I make a consecutivity test. We want 5 consecutive 3 sigma samples where you're 3 sigma above this baseline, and one of them has to be 5 sigma. So this in total is 7.5 sigma, I think. And then have to do a hot pixel test. Now, a hot pixel in these 814 frames, because we have a 4-point box there, looks like sort of a 2x2 bright thing. This does not look like a PSF. The PSF is like 10 pixels. The hot pixels are definitely 4, and the bright ones are very clear. So what I do is I do a running stack of 5 difference images. So just add them. And then we expect that point sources are extended objects, and you can make a test on sort of the ratio of sort of a central core to outskirts. And for a hot pixel with no noise, that's supposed to be infinite, whereas for a PSF, it's sort of like 2. And so I can make a test with some noise and subtract hot pixels in this way.
Are your hot pixels spatially invariant so that they're always replicated within the chip? And those hot pixels on a chip remain fixed on a chip, so you know actually beforehand where the hot pixels are?
Yes. The trouble is that some of these hot pixels aren't all that hot, and they're not in hot pixel lists. It's just that they only become a problem if you're trying to look for variable sources.
Right, but it's something which is not varied from frame to frame.
Right, yeah. Yeah, though our pointing errors are sort of less than half a pixel, typically, from frame to frame. So our sources aren't moving much either. But that is something, that can be done. Okay. Subtracted the hot pixels, we've done the consecutivity test, and then we do a chi-squared fit of the light curve, sort of take some junk fits, a step function. Some of the hot pixels do look like step functions. They have sort of dark noise, and then decide they want a different dark noise. Linear fit, actually very few of the candidates are best fit by a linear fit, but that may be interesting for some sorts of variable stars. And then just do a degenerate microlensing fit. And basically, for each light curve, we require that the microlensing is the best fit with a significant delta chi-squared. And in fact, given all of this, we're not so sensitive to the precise value of this delta chi-squared. You can lower this actually quite a bit and not add too much junk. So once we go through all this, then we see what candidates are left, and then we pretty much need to do a visual inspection for subtraction artifacts. And we find a few. This is sort of at the level of a handful. And they're pretty much all at the sort of the outer edges of bright globular clusters. And we think we understand why. Because you have the PSF sampling the center of the globular cluster, but the PSF squared, which is what you construct the noise image from, is much more peaked. So the PSF squared is not sampling the center of the globular cluster, so you think the noise is lower than it is. So, I mean, it's I think, fairly clear that sort of at the outskirts of the globular clusters, you might expect to have subtraction artifacts where you see you think you have a detection. But, I mean, those are easy enough to spot. I mean, there's a bright globular cluster, there's a candidate event sitting on the edge, and you can say, okay, that's junk. All right. How am I doing? So, we have some candidate events. In the WIFC 2, which is the chip that I developed this all on, we got lucky. There were four candidates, and one of them is an obvious subtraction artifact. In the WIFC 3, two candidates, they're both artifacts. And the WIFC 4, there's nothing. All right, well, we have three excellent candidate variable sources. One of them is a nova candidate in a globular cluster, sort of it's got a m of sort of roughly -8 magnitudes in I. This is very rough. I haven't done the photometry very carefully yet. There's one candidate, sort of an unidentified declining tail of something. A little unfortunate, but it's quite nice candidate. And we have an excellent microlensing candidate, peak brightness around -6.5 magnitudes in I. So we've just done some...
What's the relative magnitudes? You're putting the absolute magnitudes
here. This is assuming a distant modulus of 31. For a distance modulus of 31 for M87. Yeah, I'm just quoting the absolute because it's, you know, a scale that people are familiar with. If I say this is a 23rd magnitude source, you know, well, how far away is it? Okay. We've just done a preliminary check on the colors. Both of these...
This declining tail event, it's as if you saw only half of the...
Yeah. Yeah, but it's definitely... It's got a definite curvature, and it's got a significant delta chi-squared from the linear fit, so it's definitely got a curvature to it.
So you have an event in half?
Yeah. I wouldn't want to call that... I wouldn't want to call that anything. And I'm not going to call that anything.
Are you going to show us the light curve?
Yes. Okay. I'm getting there. So I've done a preliminary check, and the nova and the microlensing candidates are there in the 606 filter. Though I only had access to a sort of 3-day medians of that, so the light curves are quite sparse. This nova candidate is in fact in a faint M87 globular cluster, so that's pretty interesting. Now we can get a crude color for the microlensing candidate, and we get a V minus I of something like 1.1. And that's encouraging just because the troublesome variable stars tend to be pretty blue or pretty red. Sort of V minus I of 2 is where the Myra variables sit. V minus I of 0 is sort of blue bumpers. Now, of course, we may have discovered some other candidate, or some other class of variable star, which, you know, we're watching so many stars, and this whole giant elliptical, essentially. That's always possible. But, you know, it's pretty bizarre. I mean, its peak is -6.5 magnitudes. The tip of the red giant branch is -4 in I, so it's a factor of 10. And furthermore, this is the extra light, so it's got to add a -6.5 magnitude star rather than be a... So this is very bright. I mean, it could be a variable, but it'd be a very weird one to do this.
Brighter than any single star in the galaxy by a factor of 5, as we just said.
No, the tip of the red giant, there are stars brighter than...
You have to be an AGB star.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like Myras are AGB stars, but they're very red.
Exactly. So, so I guess I'm saying, given that color and that magnitude, put it on the color magnitude diagram, yeah. There's no such star.
Well, maybe we just found one. There's always that worry. Yeah.
But that amplitude corrected, or that's after?
This is, I think, these numbers are so crude that it's essentially the entire, that's the excess, is sort of -6.5. But these are pretty crude. Don't quote me on these.
Well, what's your signal to noise roughly? I mean, and what's magnitude do you go to in your single exposures and one your snapshots? What absolute magnitude?
Top to bottom, this is sort of about 8 or 9 sigma. this.
So you can't even see the tip of the Red Giant branch, or you just...
Yeah.
I'm just trying to get a sense of which stars you're actually able to see.
No, we couldn't see, because that's 2.5, that's a factor of 10. No, we couldn't see a 27th
so
magnitude.
You're only seeing EGB stars in terms of your source.
Well, unless you magnify them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But even the AGB stars, they're not resolved. There's just too much. It's too far away. Okay. So, as promised, light curves. Here's a globular cluster nova. Just goes boom, and it's sort of a, I'm told this is a fairly typical fast and bright nova. So this is a really nice event. Actually, Dave Zurich and Mike Shara at the Museum of Natural History got involved in this project to look for novae. Well, they got one.
I'm sorry for my ignorance. How do you say, how do you know this is a nova?
Well, for one thing, it's so bright. I mean, this is sort of -8 magnitudes. It looks like a nova in light curve, and I mean, of course, we can't be sure.
Proposed on is what it would look like if it were a
microlensing. Yeah, so this is the best fit microlensing curve.
Yeah. That doesn't fit.
No. Yeah, this is a very bad chi-squared. I think this is a chi-squared per degree of freedom of like 3. That's pretty bad. Here's our declining event tail. Too bad. Oh well, but it's interesting.
What's the Apollo logic plan here?
Hmm?
What's the Apollo logic there?
Oh, I don't know. This is Yeah, I haven't fit a power law to it, but the microlensing fit is full with half maximum of 15 days.
Chi-squared there?
This is pretty good chi-squared. It's sort of, you know, you get the good fits are sort of chi-squared unity per degree of freedom. And the delta...
Z equals 1.7 supernova.
That's much better.
Maybe even... Right.
And yeah, the delta chi-squared between this and the linear fit is also significant. So there's the curvature is detected cleanly.
So
and
I'm sorry, again, why don't you consider a microlensing event? I mean, just seeing half of it, if nothing else, no other curve fits, well,
it might be some variable thing. We're not done with this analysis.
Okay.
You have to be careful. Always have to be very careful about variable stars. We want to see what the color is and.
Okay. But if there's the same variation in color, if the color's right and. I mean,
yeah, then you might start saying something. Yeah.
Later on.
It could be. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're not talking about color because you haven't done the analysis yet.
Right, I haven't mentioned, I mentioned the color for this event, which I'm going to show. We sort of have a crude color. Okay, so this is our microlensing candidate. It's got a full with half maximum of 6 days. You know, chi-squared per degree of freedom of unity, and this is, couldn't have Monte Carlo'd something nicer than this. What about you, but this looks gorgeous. Anyway, couldn't have drawn a better one. You know this?
Especially how the peak came exactly when you were looking.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a great candidate, and as I said, its V minus I color is sort of consistent.
It's perfectly symmetric, even the airlines.
It's not, you know, there are some. The chi-squared is around 1. The chi-squared isn't too small.
This wasn't your test case you injected into the data.
No. This is actual data. You know, I am a theorist. This is actual data.
You're Bell Labs.
No, I'm a Columbia.
No,
LBF. Yeah. All right. I mean, this is sort of a crude color. The thing exists in the other band. This is really crude, but it's there. It goes up. It's roughly the same time scale of the center and the width. And the color, as I said, is sort of minus 1 or so. V minus I is 1 or so.
How long after taking the data did it take you before you could see this?
It was quite a while. Yeah. Well, yeah, Todd Lauer had a you know, real big effort in the analysis.
We're not in a position to say, hey, give us another day of HST data.
Well, hopefully, no. We're not reducing this on the fly.
Yeah, so.
No, hopefully we're going to have this, have some papers out by Christmas so we can submit an advanced camera proposal to sort of repeat this experiment. because you have about 10 times the sensitivity.
Do you have color for every point?
Well, you can just measure what it is in each point, yeah.
Okay, so you can show us V minus I as a function of day.
Yeah, well, really what that is just, you know, is the joint fit good? Is the joint fit taking T0, the peak position, and T1/2, the width, is that joint fit a good fit? So you're just having one value for both colors. I mean, that's what you can...
are there any systematic errors that you can see in looking at color indices as a function of time?
It doesn't look like it, but we haven't done the full color analysis yet.
That would be a powerful test for whether this is a microlensing event or some other.
Well, yeah, in pixel lensing, it's a little tricky because all you have is the achromaticity is constant with time. You don't actually get the, you don't know the magnifications in either band because there's too much blending. All right, so of course we want to compare this. Okay, we have an event. You know, well, how many do we expect? So now that I've got this rigmarole, I can generate by Monte Carlo some light curves and run them through the same analysis and compute the efficiency of detecting microlensing events. And then you use that efficiency to do a rate calculation for M87 and the Virgo cluster, including the self-lensing contribution. The self-lensing is, you have a big ball of stars, you're going to have some self-lensing. Well, we expect about 1.5 events from the full, from both halos being full with lens objects, and the self-lensing rate is sort of like 0.01. We expect about 0.01 events.
How do you model the Virgo cluster halo?
We just assume that the velocity dispersion is sort of 1,000 kilometers a second. It's got a big core, sort of, I don't know, what was it, 300 kiloparsecs, and you put the M87 halo with a much smaller core of sort of 5 kiloparsecs on top of that. So, yeah, the modeling is sort of preliminary. And in fact, it turns out that the M87 and Virgo cluster halo contributions are similar.
If there are cluster machos.
Yeah.
Distributed just throughout the cluster, not associated with any individual galaxy halo.
Yeah.
Is that included?
That's included. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the M87 and the Virgo cluster, both.
Ted, you've got a great result, but why would you do the experiment if that's what you expected?
Well, our preliminary simulations were a little optimistic. And then, as always, you know, when you actually get the real data and you apply the tests you really need to do to filter, to analyze your data, it looks a lot worse than what you started out with.
And the reason why there's so much more self-lensing in the LNC was because of what Gary said, that the halo was so much more important here.
No, that the halo is so much less important. Here, I mean, this is the entire Virgo cluster. This is this enormous, this is a giant.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So in other words, in this case, the halo is much more relatively than it would
yes.
be in the LNC.
Right.
So therefore,
yeah. All right. But now this is sort of a preliminary cut. We're trying to push this lower to see, you know, can we lower the threshold and still get rid of the hot pixels and, you know, get this expected event rate up? So we're sort of in the midst of doing that. Of course, lowering the threshold increases the expected rate. I think these are old numbers. I'm still working on this.
Lowering the threshold of what?
Well, lowering the threshold to detect an event. Say we're requiring 5 consecutive 3 sigmas with a 5 sigma. Well, we can, you know, maybe play around with that to lower the threshold. For example, the hot pixel analysis could use some improvement. The trouble is that these sort of low activity hot pixels are not troubling unless you're doing a variability search. So really there's not much expertise around on these things. But this is all a work in progress. There we go. So what we need to do is test the time-independent color, or equivalently test the goodness of the joint fit to do both bands and get the source V minus I colors and in a less crude fashion. I'd like to include the PC chip also. Though for a microlensing survey like this, the event rate is roughly independent of surface brightness. So this is a small area, so you don't expect a huge improvement in the number of detected sources. As I said, we want to lower the threshold, improve the hot pixel analysis. We're going to need to do some artificial star tests just to see whether artificial variable stars in this case, pass the hot pixel test. And maybe see if there's some baseline data in the HST archive, though, as it turns out, our data set is mostly rotated 180 degrees for most of the stuff in the archive, so we don't have very much overlap. And we want to do a better simulation, do a maximum likelihood like I showed in the beginning for M31, though with one event, that's not going to be very significant. So we're really, I don't know that we can answer this with any certainty with this data set, but you know, the question is there a halo lens population in M87 in the Virgo cluster? And again, this is a much longer distance scale than even towards M31 or towards the LMC. This is sampling larger objects that are dark matter dominated. So, you know, where does this lens, if there is a lens population, where does it crap out? I mean, are there really lenses at all length scales in objects? And hopefully, we're gonna apply for some advanced camera time. It's about 10 times as sensitive to this sort of survey, and that would be really great if we could do that. So that's all I have.
Wait, are you really 10 times more sensitive in V?
Well, in I. Yeah. It's 4.5 times just in photon counting, and the area is like twice as big.
No, in V,
it's not as big a factor. But since we're basing this in I, it's about 4.5 times in I.
I didn't quite follow the details, but you throw out on this hot pixel problem.
Yeah.
You throw out the hot pixels because they're a single pixel and they're not spread out the way a star would.
Right. That's the test, essentially.
Because I have a thought learned from painful experience and a little background. Which is that we had some weird sources of noise, and we were terrified that they were background, so some contamination. But there's one way you can distinguish them, and that is that they're not Poisson at time.
Hmm.
So, of course, good events, good things here should be, the photon counting should be Poisson at time. So, well, hot pixel is some German or pixel or something, it might not be Poisson. So you could use that as a way of telling that.
Huh. Though, with only 30 samples, I don't know how well that test would go. I mean, I could show you some of the hot pixel light curves, and a lot of them are just, you know, they look like step functions, and some of them...
Exactly.
Well, some of them look like, you know, a double step function, which, you know, is not a terrible...
So the way of doing that, so scientifically, to see if they're plus one time.
Well, but then you throw out, but then you're... Your microlensing events, also they go up and down. And
no, but the counting rate is plus.
Well,
the photons are coming randomly.
But you don't have the time for each photon. You just have the photons in a bin. I don't, we can talk.
How often do you collect the photons?
Once, 30 times total.
Once a day?
Yeah, once a day. We just have 20, those the data points that I showed, I mean, you just read out the CCD once.
Oh, I understand that. What's the exposure
time? It's a 4.260 second bither in I. So that's 1,040 seconds total, and then a 400 second exposure in the V-ish filter. So we have 1,440 seconds.
So, I mean, from the fact that there's maybe one or less than two events, can you put an upper limit to the Macho fraction of the Virgo cluster mass?
I suppose we could, but with one event, you know.
Well, I seem to recall that my colleague Andy Gould some years ago made a proposal that I thought was extreme, which said maybe as much mass as in hot gas could be in machos. And I suspect you may be able to rule that out.
Well, I mean, the hot gas is sort of a small fraction of the total mass of the cluster.
So, I don't know, 6, 7, 8%.
But the trouble is that we expect 1.5 and we detect 1. So essentially, we're saying it's the whole cluster, which obviously is if this is a microlensing event, we got really lucky. You know,
assuming there are more machos than the massive galaxies in Virgo. Because there's about 10 times as much baryons in, or maybe more, but about 10 times as much baryons in the hot gas as in the individual Virgo galaxies. So
right.
If I said there was as much mass in machos, that would be 10 times as much as was in the galaxies, and that's much more than what you would have, I think, for the galaxy or for the LMC. That's why I thought you could maybe even rule that out at this point.
Well, one event.
Your model was a model.
Well, one event, we have 1.5. I don't know what you can say with
the
that.
The model was not that you have 10 times as many machos as, I think, as you have mass in galaxies.
Well, no, the model was, you know, what's the mass of the M87, which is mostly dark, and what's the mass of the Virgo cluster, and that's mostly dark, and just assume that they're all lenses. And can you say anything about the... So it really doesn't... So, I mean, I just assume some smooth Virgo cluster halo. So that's something we're working on. Any other questions?
Yeah, the 1.5 lenses in what fraction of the halo?
That's the full halo.
You saw one? It's unbelievable. It's beautiful. It really is.
There's still 1.5.
It's crazy.
No, so when they get 10 times as much data, they're not going to see anything more.
Well, we might see one. Again.
That's amazing. It's great.
So yeah, I think we got lucky on this one.